another exciting episode of Extra Feature Entertainment. We have a fabulous guest all the way from England who's up late with me. Thank you so much. Mikhail Chowdhury, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on. Very happy to be here.
His film, Ami Victoria, we're discussing today, and I think it's just on the festival circuit, correct?
That's right, yeah. It's been on the festival circuit for about 6 or 7 months now. Ami Victoria, it's a short film that we produced entirely remotely during COVID in 2020. And we've been very fortunate to have tremendous success on the festival circuit. I believe it is being selected for about 23 festivals now, including the Oscar qualifying Real Sisters of the Diaspora. And it's won a couple of awards, which is really gratifying. It could be the circumstances we made it in.
So let's start at the beginning. You're a writer on this, and you did the music on this. You didn't direct it.
I didn't direct it, no. We had a wonderful director, Christy Farris, who is an actress who's been in Scrubs, Goliath, Monogamy, and tons of different shows over the years, and this was her directorial debut, in fact, and she absolutely crushed it, did a fantastic job.
Now, you yourself are an actor also. You've done a lot of acting.
And you dabble.
Dabble, okay, you dabble.
I would call myself a dabbler. It's very easy. You make it sound like I do so many things, and what I would say, I think I'm probably pretty good doing a lot of things not that well, but juggling them all at the same time, which is my great skill.
Well, I only have one skill. I can talk to people. That this is about it for me. Don't expect anything else. So when you're writing something like this, was this a COVID-developed script, or was this in development before COVID?
Yeah, so this came out of a short-form series that we made in 2020. So just to remind everyone, not everyone needs reminding of what COVID was doing, but obviously in March sort of 2020, we were all still living in a bit of denial about it. And I had a feature film that I was developing, which had a table read with an audience, we had initial development funding, and then lockdown happened, everything in the industry went on hold, all the projects went on hold, and I decided that it would be really great to just try and make something, since we're all stuck at home, unable to do anything. So I reached out to a couple of people, including the very talented Sana Soni. Sana Soni is actually in distribution. She's a distribution executive at 1091 Pictures in LA now. At the time, she was moving country and she had some free time. So I got to work with her as a co-showrunner. Then reached out to a bunch of friends and people I knew and contacts in the industry to say, I just want to make something. And that something ended up developing into a short form web series called The Myth of Control. And The Myth of Control hasn't been released yet because we are still talking to distributors and also potential other networks about developing it into a full-length series. So we haven't done that. But that show, just to give you an example of this, we went from concept to locked scripts in 3 weeks for a 7-episode series with 10 minutes each episode. We had people in 28 cities, 8 countries around the world. We were running across multiple time zones when we did it. Writers' rooms were all virtual. Everything was done virtual. Directors, everything was done. And we shot that on an iPhone, to be precise, my wife's iPhone. She was very kind and lent us that. We cleaned it out. We put the Filmic Pro app on, which is a brilliant app, and sent it with a couple of softbox lights, a very basic camera package, and a PDF how-to guide that we put together ourselves. And each of the actors sort of took it in turn, shot in their own house, filmed it themselves while being directed over Zoom or Google Meet by, we had 7 different directors. I directed one episode. We had 6 other fantastic directors who did other episodes. And we had a sort of DP tech advisor that was doing everything online. So it was kind of bonkers, even more bonkers than the usual filmmaking. But we got it made insanely fast. It was wrapped, completed, packaged, still while we were all under lockdown. And out of that, we were then looking in 2021 at what to do with it in terms of promotion, which is another thing all filmmakers face and all writers is how do you actually promote the thing once you made it. And we decided that we would take one of the episodes and recut it as a short film and use that in the festival circuit to try and draw some attention to it because we'd made it in such an unusual sort of way. Ami Victoria was episode 3 of the series and it was the one that lent itself best to that. And it's a particularly special episode because it has 2 profoundly deaf female actors, women of color, Stephanie Nogueras, who is a wonderful actress. She's been in Grimm. She's recurring in The Good Fight. Natasha Oefele, another wonderful actress. She's been on Netflix, The Politician. She's in the Marvel Universe through Spider-Man, Miles Morales, and the video game. So these are great actors we had, and we had to do all of that using sort of remote technology to be able to communicate between each other, because we, the hearing and the able-bodied team, didn't know American Sign Language, so we had to find ways to communicate and make sure that we could work with them and make it comfortable for them to do, which we managed mainly because of the team. So that's the long-winded explanation of how this came about. It was a short-form series. We tried to make something, and we found a way to, this sort of slightly crazy way to do it, which somehow worked. Yeah, and that's how we evolved it.
Okay, we got it. There's way too much stuff we didn't get into there. Let's start the easy part. Why sign language? I mean, that's not something that everyone speaks, but it was something different. So you're do you know sign language?
I do not know sign language. I know a little bit now. So I know my American Sign Language is not great. It's passable enough to have a conversation, but it's not brilliant. At the time when we created the show, so I created the kind of the overall concept. I created the characters and the concept of the series is that there are six people who are all friends who are still, we set it during the pandemic, but it's pandemic adjacent. So it's not about being in the pandemic. That really is there purely because we had to have a narrative reason for them never to actually physically meet and to be kind of not seeing other people. So we use that. But what it's really about is this group of friends who are all going through their own sort of grief, their own grievances, their own challenges and things. And you see each episode is like a day, the same day, followed by each person during that same day. And then it's wrapped up with this joint Zoom call, which you see bits of during the course of the series, and included in that is a kind of a mystery element, because one of the friends has died recently, and so there's a bit of mystery around how that person died, and there's also a bit of mystery around another character who's been involved in a conspiracy theory and a crime relating to that. So it's a bit of a mix of things. It's kind of a drama, but it has different types of episodes in there, including sort of romance, including comedy. So that's how that started. And when I put together the characters, and we evolved again very fast, I wanted it to be about communication between people, because characters were able to be together. And one thing I always recognized is that we don't really see deaf representation out there very much. We see stories where you have deaf people, where it's not about someone being deaf, it's just a story and the people happen to be deaf. I'm a big fan of trying to show stories and have characters and have people behind the camera who are from underrepresented communities. I myself, I'm mixed race, I'm Muslim, I'm an immigrant. I rarely see myself presented on screen, even now. And back in the day, I never saw myself presented on screen, not in a good way anyway. It was only in a bad way. I'm Bangladeshi and I'm Mexican, and brown Muslims and Mexicans do not generally get portrayed in a positive light or even a normal light on screen. So you get to see this. So I'm always about looking for ways to try to bring that out and do that, and do it in a way that makes sense. So that's how that concept came about, is how the characters evolved. That episode with the two deaf women, I then had a co-writer, a fantastic writer, Hannah Harmison. Hannah is based out in the DMV area, and she's wonderful. She's not deaf, but she does know ASL, and she knows a lot of people in the deaf community, so she was able to write a fantastic script with a really great authentic elements to it. And then, of course, we also ran that script past not only other members of the deaf community, but also past both of the actors to see, are you comfortable with this? Are we representing it correctly? Are there changes we need to make this actually more accurate to how you guys would be?
Wow, that's a lot. So when you first started writing, you've just told me that you wanted to see yourself represented, which you did. The two women are very, very distinct, and they don't look like me, which is fine. I couldn't care less. I just want a good story. Now, in doing that, did you try it with two men ever in your head, or was it always two women, or you knew these two women and saying, okay, I know these two people, I'm going to go that way?
Yeah, so it actually, so the character started off with Amy, the character played by Natasha Oakley. That was the first character, and she is one of the group of six friends that is the core of the series. And then when, and it sounds, it is, it's the sort of thing that sounds very pretentious when you go and say it, because people say, why, you know, why was she then, why was she gay? Why did she have, why did
her
other half like that? And the truth is, it wasn't a conscious thought on it. It was just when I was coming up with the character, thinking about her episode, and her episode was then going to be the kind of romantic comedy sort of episode, it went in, and it just made logical sense that she would be. And so that's how Victoria came about, basically. And then, yeah, it's kind of one of those ones. They just were. So they were never two men. They were never a man and a woman. They just ended up being two women. That's also what happens when you give yourself like half a day, essentially, to create all the characters for a series. You don't really have time to think about it and run through permutations.
And then you got people like me. So what's the background coming from here?
Yeah, I know. I wish I could give a really complex answer. Well, there was this time I was trekking through the Andes. No, I was just like, I hastily had to put this thing together, and it just sort of fell into place.
So I'm going to give you the easy answer. So choice of clothing, I presume, was just what they had for themselves. And did they do any set design on their room? Because I wish I knew the character's names. One of them definitely looks like they set design. The other one, not so much.
Yeah, so we did. So we had an amazing... So again, for this series, this is the really remarkable thing. We had a full behind it. We had a production designer. We had a costumer. Costumer Caitlin Elwood, who is wonderful, really talented, she went and she spent time with each of the actors beforehand, going through their closet remotely, so they would have sort of Zoom and show her pieces that they had, show her things. She came up with the ideas for what each character would wear and how to base the colours, etc., on them, based on what they had, and if there was anything in particular that we needed them to have that was missing, we'd sort of find a way to order it cheaply online and send it over to them through Amazon or something else. And in terms of production design, we had an incredible PD, Polly Aspinall, who was actually, bear in mind, both of these actors were based in LA. Caitlin was at the time, Caitlin was always traveling somewhere, but she was kind of in New Mexico, I think, at the time, and Polly was in London. So that's where everyone was coming, and I was in DC at the time, and Sana was in London, I think, and Christy was in LA. It was insane. It was just everyone was everywhere. So Polly went, and for the production design, she took photos that they sent of their houses, and then she drew up a PDF, marked out things to move to different places, what bits to do. We had to order a couple of items. We got a cushion dropped off for one of the characters, but somebody else dropped for the other character. In terms of the wardrobe, Caitlin walked through. If there were any accessories we needed, we sent them over. So it was all very specific. And you're right, we made a deliberate choice with this. The one character, her color palette is very much yellow, blue,
yes,
kind of bright. It's very toned. It's very specific because she's kind of created her own safe world for herself where she's not leaving her room, really, and not really going out and doing stuff. And then the other character's got very neutral tones. It's all very natural. So it's a lot of browns, it's beige and things. And again, that's because she's really kind of facing up to what's going on. So she looks a little less polished in that thing, which is a sort of deliberate contrast between the two. So yeah, we went to some pretty great lengths, but this is a great testament to the actors. They were very open to allow us to shoot within their homes and to make use of their own wardrobe and some clothing.
So was this, it sounds like you guys were going crazy. You got one person here, one person. So how did this all come together into such a nice, neat short film?
Yeah, we did go crazy. There's no question. I think we lost our minds a little bit in the process. I'll be honest. This is a really, it's a testament to, and anything that's good about this film, anything that's good about the series, in fact, if anything that's good about anything I do, really, is rarely, rarely ever to do with my involvement. It's nearly always because of the other much more talented people who are on board for it. So in this project, we had so many brilliant people who were just sitting at home, all their work dried up, all their things gone, and they were just so lovely and thrilled to be able to create that they gave everything to this project. They really did. And that was, yeah, that involved them just finding creative ways to work around it, things that went wrong, everyone just off got on with it. The levels of patience, the levels of good humor that were involved were really, this only happened because there was just an amazing team of people that got behind it. Yeah.
So, when you are, have you ever forgotten somebody's big day? Because that is part of this little short. Did that ever happen to you?
I tend to be quite good at remembering that, but it's happened the other way around. So we've seen that.
So is that where the genesis came from? You were like, oh, I remember a time when somebody forgot something. Let's see what I can do with that.
No, I think we, again, from a writer's perspective, I think we just needed a focal point. We needed a kind of a flashpoint in this. So you have two characters, and the two characters in the film, their relationship is already a bit strained for a number of reasons, and we just needed a kind of flashpoint to be, okay, this is, we're approaching the straw that could break the back for it. And it was very in keeping with the character of Amy that she would forget this day, because she, as a character, has been so sort of caught up in her own challenges and their own difficulty and the mindset and things around it that were going on. And then equally for Victoria, you know, she, the reason it carries so much additional importance is because she's been stuck at home taking care of her father the whole time, and so, you know, not, she's feeling even more isolated in a different way, and so that's why there's such a sort of clash between the two.
Okay. You have a scene with the ice cream. Now, I wanted to know if the ice cream was left over from lunch, or that was already in the script.
The ice cream was in the script. Yeah, so it was very deliberate. Everything we had in there, all the things that happened were all very specifically in the script, and they were all planned. And again, we had, interestingly enough, because we didn't have, sometimes in a film, then you can play with stuff, you can have improvisation, you can allow for more space. For this series, we didn't have any room. We sent this sort of camera system, and the way we set this up, just so people understand how it worked. So we have this iPhone, and there's an app which you can get for your smartphone called Filmic Pro. It's a great app by some guys in Seattle, and it basically turns your phone into a, it unlocks all the camera features on your phone. Things, even rack focus and stuff on it. It's great. But we've got a tripod. Someone within their COVID bubble is the camera operator. None of the camera operators had ever held a camera in their lives. None of them knew how to shoot a film or anything. And then we've got a bunch of us on a video call who are then guided through it and being like, okay, can you turn the camera this way? Can you set it to that? Can you shift to that? And they're playing around with it. And that all happens because we connected the phone. We sort of screen mirrored the phone top, which they then use on the video conference, and all of it the behest of the gods of Wi-Fi, because when it wasn't running fast at home, then everything freezes, so then they hold up a cell phone behind the camera phone to show us what's going on. It was insane in terms of getting shot. So the reason I explain all that is so that when we went in, we had to be very deliberate. So we had a fantastic script production team who broke down each script line by line. We had every piece, every prop, every item was planned beforehand. It was all very strictly managed because we had to do all this for each one. I mean, that film was shot in the equivalent of about 2.5 days, and it was 2.5 days in this way of shooting without crew or people who were doing. So it wasn't a lot of time. So there's no resting. The one thing I do say, excuse me, the ice cream, if you may have seen it, she actually knocked it over in her excitement at the end of that moment, which wasn't in the script, and I never asked her because I always felt bad about it. They had to change their duvet cover just because of that.
Well, I did write my notes, didn't get messy, but I figured I wasn't going to. So I did notice. I'm like, okay, now you have your project finished, and you're the writer, and really, there's no dialogue. So obviously, the beats are all ASL beats. How is writing music to that? Like, did you already know what you were doing? Like, that's what I'm interested in. Because usually I have kind of composers looking for beats in the thing. Oh, somebody's running, somebody's flying, somebody's going crazy. Like, you have options, but here there's no sound, really. other than your music.
That's right. So, so I composed the end credits music, actually, and I put a few other scenes through the series. But the music for that episode was done. We had several different composers that worked on the music, and I worked with a couple other people who had produced music. I didn't have a lot of music in this. I did a little bit, but it wasn't a big thing. I wasn't the music person. But this episode was a wonderfully wonderful. Suzanne is just fantastically talented, and she scored that, and I think she scored definitely one other, maybe even two other episodes, and she did completely different parts of one. So for that one, she basically decided that the instrument of choice for the characters would be the piano, was her starting point, and she just created it. So as you say, she didn't have necessarily a dialogue beat to have, but she worked through the emotional beats for it. So then the pace of the music kind of goes a little lower key, a little more minor key in some, then picks up a little bit more, gets a little more playful at moments. There's a scene where one of the characters is kind of rehearsing the sort of the things that she's doing, and so she makes it a little more upbeat and bouncy at that point. So that's how she did. But I was really pleased with what she did. I felt she actually managed to add additional level to it. And music really is, so many people forget about music in film. It's really, you're giving me a look, which is like skeptical, but I know composers who have told me, they've had directors that have come and said to them, I kind of forgot that we need to score this, which is just insane. I know, it's kind of crazy, but I think it's this thing that if a lot of people that make films, they're purely focused on a visual piece, I think, and this assumption that music just kind of gets done in the back end. So, but we didn't take that line. We had the composers on board early, we got them on board, we got them involved with the script, so they had plenty of time and understood what was going on.
I find that weird that a director would come up to somebody and go, oh, I need some music. To me, that's just such an integral piece of most film is music. And I'm not saying the music should stand out in any piece, but it should accompany the piece of any kind. And yours accompanies wonderfully at all times. Like, I never felt, oh, that piece of music shouldn't be here. I loved it. I loved that there was no dialogue. The music was my dialogue.
Yeah. And thank you.
Help me get through it. So your writing was perfect that way, that you were giving emotion, and the music would accompany that and really help me feel a little bit more.
Thank you. I appreciate that, yeah. And I think, look, music, when it's at its best in a film, I think is where it adds something, it tells the audience something that they're not getting from what's going on in the screen, on the screen, is when it's at the best. And Suzanne really, I think, just nailed it with that one. And again, like I said, I mean, the credit to the script, a lot of that goes to Hannah, who really got those emotions in a very short time period and was able to give that to her.
So we're almost done, just so we have two things left to do for me. One,
no worries.
Favorite movie, because first time on the show.
Yeah, so my favorite movie is Blade with Wesley Snipes.
Love Blade.
I love it. So it's really funny. I always say that. I've had so many people look at me skeptically when I said it, but no, I think it's amazing. I remember seeing it in the movie theater back when it came out, way back in the day. I still love it. It's super dark. I mean, it's David Goyer's writing in it, which is fantastic. I think Wesley Snipes was just perfect for the role at the time. I should say I'm very excited about seeing Mahershala Ali doing it. I think he's going to be great.
So, just back to Blade for a second. Blade hooked me in that opening dance number in the dance club and the blood starts coming out. That worked so well for me in a film. Like, yeah, I'm in. Never had any issues with Blade right after that scene.
No, I agree. It's one of the best openings of any movie. It's also probably one of the best intros to a character as well. Right after that, when he just suddenly appears, it's phenomenal.
So, I only have two questions for you. My second one is, what film would you recommend that's underrated people need to see?
Oh, yeah, that's a really good question. Yeah, I mean, the thing is, there are so many around that. I would say that so they did a remake of it with Jake Gyllenhaal, which is on Netflix at the moment, which is called, I think they called it the same name, The Innocent.
The Guilty.
That's right. The originals, and I haven't watched the remake. I'm sure it's great. I'm sure they did a great job. But the original, if you ever get a chance to watch it, is absolutely brilliant. And it's a real masterclass in how to create tension with very, very little. I think they did, it's a really great, when you're filmmaking, then one of the key things is trying to place your resources, particularly when doing low budget or indie filmmaking. And so I always respect people that were smart enough to say, well, we don't have X, Y, and Z, so let's make sure it fits within the script and the story to what it is. And there, I think it was their first film actually out of film school, and they set the whole thing in predominantly one room. There's a second room that it happens in as well. It's an enclosed space. Most of the dialogue happens off screen. It's very, very cleverly done, very well acted, very performed, and I just thought it was fantastic. I really enjoyed that.
Well, I have seen the film. I agree with you 100%. It is a fabulous film that not too many people see. Before I let you go, tell everybody where they can find all your stuff.
Absolutely. So I'm on Instagram. My handle is at midnightcaller _ The Myth of Control is on under, it's at The Myth of Control, just The Myth of Control. Instagram is where we post most of the stuff around this, so keep that on there. And of course, people can Google me and check my IMDb if they want to have any other information. But anyone that wants to, always very welcome to reach out and to speak to people about collaborating or seeing other things.
Thank you for your time and have a great evening.
Thank you. This was wonderful.